Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, may it please the court.
It does.
My name is Steve Stenger. I am arguing on behalf of the appellant in this matter. We are here from a transfer from the Missouri Court of Appeals Eastern District. The case below, and I should say that the trial court case, involved convictions by a jury of one count of assault in the first degree and one count of armed criminal action. And the Missouri Court of Appeals held that it would reverse and remand for a new trial. However, in light of the general interest and importance of the issues involved, the case was transferred to this honorable court. Below, the jury found Mr. Letizia guilty of the crimes that I have indicated. And the basic gist of the case below was that the indictment charged that Mr. Letizia cut and stabbed a particular individual with a knife during an altercation. Mr. Letizia claimed self-defense at trial, and the trial court sentenced Mr. Letizia to 15 years imprisonment for each count, with the sentences to run concurrently. The issue that I would like to particularly address today was my count two at the appellate court, and I have changed that count to count one in my substitute brief before this court.
The appellate court decision is not before, it's the trial court decision that we're reviewing. When we took transfer, you don't have to respond to the court.
Certainly,
the appellate court decision.
And I do understand that, Your Honor. I just thought that it was important to note that below, the appellate court had indicated that it would have reversed and remanded. And I know that is not binding upon you. I understand.
Just get on with your issues.
Certainly, Your Honor. Perhaps the most important thing below was the exchange at the trial court that occurred. During voir dire, this was the following exchange, and I'll summarize it to the extent that I'm able to, but it is very important. The prosecutor had indicated that it was obviously conducting its voir dire. It focused on one particular juror. That juror was Juror Weiss. Asked her some questions. She didn't have much to respond to. The conversation that went on was as follows. It states here that you work for Express Scripts. Is that correct? Yes. And how long have you been doing that? She responded, 2 years. And they asked her basically anything that you've heard so far that you believe you could not be fair and impartial and not follow the law. She indicated no. Defense counsel used peremptory challenges to strike four Caucasian females, including this particular potential juror, Ms. Weiss, from the panel. The state raised a reverse Batson objection to striking the four Caucasian females, including Ms. Weiss. And the state argued that Ms. Weiss didn't say anything and noted that a number of the veneer persons struck through defense counsel's peremptory challenges were Caucasians.
Now, peremptory challenges aren't protected by the Constitution, and so how has your client been denied a right to a fair and impartial jury by having this particular juror serve?
Your Honor, although state statute, well, I should say, although it is not a constitutional provision that protects his right to peremptory challenges, we do, of course, as you stated, have a statute that does so. In this particular case, and I believe in many of the cases that I've cited, and also a case of the state versus Johnson, which this court, where this court addressed the issue collaterally in a footnote, those courts have held that the denial of a peremptory challenge is a structural error.
Was the Johnson case before or after the Rivera case?
The Johnson case, Your Honor, was actually before the Rivera case.
So why would it have any relevance? I mean, up until the Rivera case, it wasn't clear that states could decide for themselves which standard applied.
And Your Honor, that's my point, is that states can decide for themselves as to whether it's a structural error analysis or an automatic reversal standard or whether it's a harmless error.
Is there another situation where we found structural error as to something which is not a constitutional error?
Well, Your Honor, actually, not absolutely directly, but Previously, and it was prior to the Rivera case, but I believe that the Rivera case leaves your dicta in Johnson unaffected. In Johnson, this court held in a, I shouldn't say held, but acknowledged in a footnote that if this court were to address the issue of someone being denied their right to a peremptory challenge, that this court would hold that that was structural error.
How is that consistent with our cases, our Court of Appeals cases, that say if you're forced to use a peremptory challenge to strike someone who should have been stricken for cause, you can't raise that as a structural error because you ended up having 12 qualified jurors, and the bad juror who should have been stricken for cause but wasn't didn't end up serving on the jury because you struck them with the peremptory challenge, so in effect you had one less peremptory challenge, yet we say that's okay. Isn't that similar to here?
Well, Your Honor, it's actually just the opposite. And if we look at the state statute, which is directly on point, our state statute, which I believe is 494.480, addresses the particular situation and says that, in fact, that a juror, well, that relief really doesn't lie unless that juror that the defendant sought to strike remained on the jury.
Right.
So I think that the situation is actually just the flip side of what we're talking about in the situation that you've raised.
What about this?
But that's because that person was an unqualified juror who should have been stricken. And here, there's no claim the juror was unqualified.
That is correct, Your Honor, but...
So it's, you're still left with someone who the person who was qualified... You're still left with a qualified jury. Why is that structural error? Why would we presume prejudice?
I think part of the reason why we would presume prejudice or why you might presume prejudice is because the situation really almost defies any analysis. How could anyone ever show, how could a proponent ever show that the individual that they sought to strike infected the jury in some way,
well,
or
isn't it,
that the... that the reason, I mean, there's an obvious reason why this particular defendant or his defense attorney didn't want Ms. Weiss on the jury. She wound up on the jury. How could we ever show on appeal that that particular person actually infected the process? And I think that that's why it affects so fundamentally.
You don't go back after the fact and say they infected the process or not. It's a, you have a three-step process where a challenge is made and you say it's not pretextual, and then another argument's made. That wasn't done here, though, was it?
And that's absolutely right, Your Honor. And that, of course, is the that's really the basis of our argument.
How do you coincide your argument with the cases that basically, if you get to a jury panel and there aren't a significant number of jurors left for both sides to get to exercise their statutorily allowed number of peremptory challenges, and so the judge, in an abundance of fairness, just limits the peremptory challenges for both sides. So if you have a unbiased juror and they take the same number away, I mean, we would require a demonstration of prejudice in those cases, correct?
That might be correct, Your Honor, but here we have a situation where that didn't happen. We have a situation where this particular defense attorney for this particular defendant identified Ms. Weiss as an individual
Batson Batson is to protect the rights of the citizen to serve on the jury, though, right? And, I mean, nobody's saying that this juror wasn't qualified. There's no bias or prejudice or anything like that that would demonstrate that this person could be struck for cause. We're talking about a peremptory strike here, and the reason for that is so that the jurors themselves aren't struck for a bad reason.
And, Your Honor, that may have been the initial strand running through Batson, but I think that that's evolved over time, and now we have even reverse Batson challenges as well.
But the reverse Batson challenges, just so that... you know, white men or white women or whatever other class has the same rights as somebody who's traditionally or historically been discriminated against. We're still talking about the juror's right to sit on the jury, not necessarily the defendant's right to just get a pick whoever they want.
But we're also, I think, mixed in there, Your Honor, is our particular statute that we have that guarantees a defendant rights to peremptory challenges.
Mm-hmm. All right, so what I'm trying to say is what makes your right to a peremptory challenge, which is not required by the Constitution, so fundamental or so important that you shouldn't have to show that you are prejudiced by the fact that you didn't get to use it?
Because I think it affects an institution that is so vital to our system of law, that being the jury. And a jury chose, we are permitted by law to choose a jury, to choose jurors, and to strike them peremptorily pursuant to Missouri state statute, jurors that, as long as you're complying with Batson and its progeny, we're permitted to do that. We have a right to do that. So I think that it's because it affects the jury, and that jury is the very body that's going to decide guilt or innocence. And because of what I've spoken about previously, which is it almost evades review, and that's why we have that three-step procedure that is set forth in Batson.
Can you address why you were prejudiced by the failure to do the third step? Because if I understand correctly, the trial court didn't find credible, or on what basis did the court decide that the person should stand? It had to be that, I mean, the only basis for saying, no, I'm going to invalidate your strike has to be that he thought it was pretextual.
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor. I think what happened in this particular case was something that was somewhat egregious. You have a situation where the trial counsel identifies reasons for why he wants to strike Ms. Weiss. He says that she was too young. He said that she didn't talk much, and then he got a bad vibe from her. None of those are prohibited.
If believed, right, exactly.
And that is, you know, it's not verbatim from the transcript, but that is what the transcript reveals, and there's, you know, I'm not making any argument there.
Right,
that is fact.
Absolutely.
So
then the state comes back and says.
And in this case, the state didn't. And that's the problem. The judge cut it off right there and said, age doesn't do it.
How's this any different from the Hy-Vee versus Ferguson case?
Your Honor,
which is the civil Batson case.
Okay.
Where the allegation was that the trial judge only did two steps instead of three.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, we also have, I think that the analysis is affected by the Johnson case, which clearly says in the dicta of this court that if a criminal defendant is denied the right to a peremptory challenge, that this court would see that as structural error.
Any other questions? Thank you. You have a chance to come back later.
Thank you
for your argument.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
May it please the court.
Oh, you can sit up here. You can sit at the council table. That's okay. Go ahead.
May it please the court. I'd like to briefly touch on the issue of the deference to be given to the trial court's determination on the reverse Batson challenge, because the standard of review is critical on that. The trial court's determination is entitled to deference on appeal, and it's only set aside if this court would find clear error. So this court would have to have a definite and firm conviction that a mistake was made. And the reason for that is that the determination depends on intangibles such as credibility and determination.
In this case, the trial court stated on the record why the trial court was denying the strike and misstated the law. So don't we get past giving deference to the trial court?
Well, I don't think we ever get past it, Your Honor, but we certainly have to look at the standard of review. We have to look at whether that determination was clearly erroneous. But part of the thing was, admittedly, the age was an improper factor to rely on. And so I think I certainly have to concede that. However, that could also go into pretext, because that had nothing to do with the case. And further, under the other factors where you examine pretext, there's no logical relevance to that determination either. Age had nothing.
I'm sorry, the trial court doesn't have to go further and make a credibility determination on defense counsel's?
on defense counsel's
reasoning and their veracity and their history of veracity with the court?
Well, that was my next point, was that this court has stated that in sustaining a Batson challenge, the trial court implicitly makes a finding that the explanation for the peremptory strike was not credible. And so the trial court may not have explicitly stated something on the record as to what they found on the credibility or whether they found pretext or whatever, but certainly in sustaining the state's challenge, the trial court was implicitly making...
But if the court here said he didn't allow the challenge because he thought it was improper to consider age, and it's not improper to consider age, then don't we know that was incorrect? There's nothing else to infer.
Well, I think still you have to apply the clearly erroneous standard. And again, the age could be pretextual. There were other factors that came into the play as well.
We don't get to add new reasons on appeal, though. The cases are clear. We can't think of reasons the trial court could have ruled the way it did. We look at what happened below. We don't figure out what might have happened where it didn't. In the Batson context, why would this be any different?
Well, certainly, but also then you determine whether it's clear error or not. And there were other factors, too, such as the fact that she wore glasses. That had nothing to do with anything, so again, it had no logical relevance. Then there was the factor that she said very little, and that had no logical relevance either.
Can you address the structural error versus harmless error analysis?
Definitely. I'll move in that direction right now, because certainly I would not concede that the trial court erred in sustaining the reverse Batson challenge. But if we do assume that and then we move on to the next step, then we look at Rivera. And certainly Rivera, the United States Supreme Court found that there isn't any freestanding constitutional right to make the peremptory challenge. The peremptory challenge is within the state's province to grant or deny. It's a statutory right under Missouri law. So therefore, I think Rivera clearly said the mistaken denial of a state-provided peremptory challenge does not violate the federal constitution. And they also said that it is not structural error. Structural error would require automatic reversal. And I think the court was quite clear in saying that this was not an error of that character.
But so, it left it to us to decide. So as a policy matter, can you help this court? What are the policy reasons why we should say as a matter of state law it's not structural error?
Well, there's certainly many on that. Of course, Rivera left it free for the states to decide, and so the states are going to have their own decisional law. Some, of course, have gone the way of its reversible error per se. Under Missouri law, of course, we have the harmless error rule, and I think as a policy determination, there is no policy reason at all to reverse the conviction in this case. Because
one policy might be the statute gives the right, and the person is denied a statutory right, and therefore there would be a policy reason to give them some relief. And because of the nature of the statutory violation of their rights, it could be virtually impossible for them to prove prejudice. So isn't that a reason to give them some remedy for the statutory violation, that we would presume prejudice?
Well, that could be a policy reason, Your Honor. However, there is no unfairness in this process here, because Jessica Weiss was not shown to be unqualified in any way. And I don't think that's necessarily a competing policy consideration either, because either way, you're looking at the right to a fair and impartial trial before a fair and impartial jury.
The unfairness could be that they're entitled to a certain number of peremptory challenges for their gut reaction to jurors, and so they unfairly were denied their right not to have this juror serve.
Well, and then the question would be, what is the remedy and why should there be a remedy? And again, I think it comes to the fairness, and that she was not shown to be unqualified or biased in any way. There is no harm to the defendant, and I think clearly under the harmless error standard, there can't be any showing here that it affected the outcome of the trial in any way. Certainly, I would say the evidence is very clear and convincing on the facts of this particular case with the stabbing that occurred.
Are you aware of any cases where trial judges have limited the number of peremptory challenges that both sides have been allowed to take based upon the deficient number of qualified jurors left in the panel?
Where it had been limited by the trial court?
Yeah, in other words, are you familiar with any reported cases where the panel got sufficiently low that there weren't enough for either side to exercise its peremptory challenges, and so the trial court just maybe eliminated a peremptory challenge from both sides, even though the statute allowed it?
Well, I'm not sure of those particular facts, except certainly under the line of cases that's been discussed so far today and in the briefing, if the defendant had to use a peremptory to remedy a situation where it should have been a strike for cause, clearly under the case law, that's not error. So that's the case law and the current version of the statute that we have. But I think in response to your question, certainly in the Carter case, that was a situation where there was a mix-up in the number of challenges and so forth, got confused a bit. But that was a civil case, and it came under a different prong of the statute. However, the court clearly said in that case that it's a prejudice inquiry that we have to look at. So, yes, I think that's absolutely critical, Your Honor. In conclusion, though, I think a remedy would be necessary when the trial would be fundamentally unfair. And certainly it's not structural error in this case. And I think that certainly the court in Rivera had given intimations of what could happen and what a court should do, because not only did they say it was not structural error, but they said that Rivera got exactly what the constitutional required. He got a fair and impartial trial before a fair and impartial jury. So I think the same is true here. And I think it's harmless error under Missouri law, just as it is under Illinois.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
You may proceed. You have 3 minutes, and I know you'll make the best of it.
Are there, if this court does not determine that it is structural error, are there other circumstances when relief is given to a criminal defendant for an error at trial without requiring the showing of prejudice? And if so, what are those circumstances?
Your Honor, I would have to think about what those situations might be. Certainly nothing is jumping to mind.
Because normally no relief is given unless, as indicated, the error materially affects the impact, or it indicates that the trial is unfair. So is there any middle ground between harmless error and structural error?
Your Honor, I don't think that there's any middle ground. I think that from what I heard from some of the questions that were posed to my opposing counsel, I think the court recognizes that this is a situation where review is very difficult, and therefore we have this, it seems to all make logical sense. We have this procedure that needs to be followed to ensure that we don't wind up where we are right now. And in this particular case, that procedure was not followed. The court clearly erred during the second prong of the Batson challenge.
We don't reverse for all errors. I mean, you know, that's just a basic.
And I understand that, Your Honor, yes. But in this situation, it is such a it is an error that goes to literally the fundamental apparatus of the decision-making, of the fact-finding at the trial. It is this very body that decides guilt or innocence, guilt or not guilty. And when that is affected, and there really is no other way that an analysis can be made after the fact of what the impact might have been or could have been, it really underlies the reason why we have that process in place, so that we can follow the steps of a Batson challenge and arrive at a decision on whether this juror, not as qualified, but whether this is a juror that, well, first of all, it's a juror that obviously the defense did not want to be on the jury for the reasons that particular defense attorney and the defendant had. So it doesn't really go to the qualification of the juror. It goes to whether or not this juror was a juror that the defendant wanted seated on that jury. And he has a statutory right, she has a statutory right to choose that jury through the peremptory strike process. You know,
if that analysis was taken to its logical conclusion, then there'd be no need for Batson even, right? Because if we were allowed to do it purely based on strategy, good reason or bad reason, the law wouldn't even be what it is. So really, when we're looking at these Batson or reverse Batson challenges, and we're trying to make this policy decision, if you will, why isn't it made from the perspective of protecting the person's right to stay on the jury, as opposed to solely looking at the defendant's right to the peremptory challenge? Because that's who we're really trying to protect, right? When we're looking at these Batson, reverse Batson challenges.
Well, I don't know that that's the only focus of the analysis, Your Honor. I think a very important focus of the analysis is who holds that statutory right to have the jury essentially, in some regard, at some level, along the continuum of their choosing, subject to everything else that we've talked about here today. We do have a defendant who has a right to his or her peremptory challenges. And in this case, those rights were violated.
This was a very good first time at the court. I hope you come back again soon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. No more questions.